So podium location 2.0, we'll only try to move it like 7 more times before we figure out where we actually want it, but we'll eventually get it somewhere. Trying to create a little more space. Lenora, so you won't sit on the second row if I'm on the first row. And so I moved a whole row back, Bill, and then she scooted back anyway. We're going to continue our look at evangelism from the perspective of the church. We're looking not at specifically what individual personal evangelism looks like, but we're looking at what an evangelistic church looks like. And last week we got started, and I knew it was a long lesson, so we went ahead and just cut it in two. And that means I'm not going to get finished with the book this quarter, but that's okay, because it's worthwhile. These two lessons, that used to be one, are more about what a healthy evangelistic church is not. So sometimes we learn by starting with negatives. I don't enjoy negatives, and nobody else does either. And I hope that it's not been my intent to just have a rattle off a series of complaints or rebukes or negative comments, but just simply to take a look at what would an unhealthy congregation look like. And last week we looked at the first four of the inward-focused church. So here was the quote that we kind of led with. No congregation sets out to be an inward-focused church. There's no conscious decision to look in instead of out. But if we don't make our relationship with the community around us a priority, we will invariably turn our eyes inward. So the comment was, this isn't something malicious that somebody decided one day, well, let's just be an inside church. But over time, it tends to kind of look inward if we allow it to. So just as a matter of good health, we have to examine ourselves honestly and ask some of the tough questions. And last week, we had the first four. The inward-focused churches fight among themselves, and we read Galatians chapter 5. And the observation from Galatians was that a lot of the internal bickering and dissension comes from a lack of doing what we're supposed to be doing. When we're working, we don't have time for as much complaining or grumbling because we're busy, right? This works at home too, right? When the kids come to you and say, I'm bored, that means they need something to do, and we can fix that. There's always chores to be done. That may not be what they were asking for, but that's what they're going to get. Anyway, right? Suddenly we're out of trouble because we have work to do. And churches work the same way for adults of all ages. When we're busy, we have less to fuss about. And so the inward-focused church isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing and reaching out to the lost. And so idle hands get into trouble, and we begin to bicker and bite and devour, is the phrase from Galatians chapter 5. Number two, the inward-focused church looks backward and not forward. And we looked at Ecclesiastes 7:10, which made the wisdom comment about asking the question, why aren't things today like they used to be, is not a wise question to ask. It doesn't say it's a wrong question to ask. It doesn't even say you're mistaken. It could be that the good old days have passed, right? It could be that you're absolutely right. But asking that question, well, why can't we go back to that, is not a wise question. And the reason it's not wise is because, for one, it's not helpful, right? Because you can't go back. Try as you might, there are no time machines. My dad did a lesson at a lectureship, 3 or 4 years ago, and his topic was growth in the churches of Christ since like the 50s or 60s, and he was kind of charting out kind of where it peaked and where it's declined and things like that. He has an interest in church history, and so that was very fascinating to him. And he read this quote from a Southern Baptist researcher that he thought just tickled him to death. He thought it was funny. And after I heard it, I thought it was funny too. And the Southern Baptist researcher, referring to their problem and ours, made the comment, if the 1960s ever come back, the Churches of Christ and the Southern Baptist are ready. But for the rest of, you know, I mean, reality is, okay, I mean, his assessment was they have the same problem, that there was a moment where those churches felt like they were at their best. And ever since, and it may be that they were. It could be that things were at their best for that moment. But since then, there's been a tendency to kind of look back at it rather than to continue to see, okay, now what do we have to do to be at our best now and the next year and the next year and the next year? And so Dad's comment was that's especially hard for him. He was becoming a preacher in that exact time period, right? That's literally when he learned how to preach. That's when he was trained. And so the easy thing for him would be to look back and say, clearly, just do it like that all the time. And he says, and it's difficult to learn new tricks. He says, I'm an old dog. It's hard to learn new tricks. And it was a moment of honesty for Dad that I appreciated. So the Inward Focus Church looks back at our golden days and says, used to be better. The example we read out of Ezra chapter 3 was at the reconstruction of the temple after the captivity. He had two groups of people. One were celebrating and say, hooray, God has given us a temple. The other group was mourning, weeping so loud you couldn't tell if they were cheering or crying, the text says, because it wasn't as beautiful as Solomon's temple. So one group was getting to see what God was doing. The other group wasn't able to be grateful or even enjoy it because for them it would never live up to the way it had been. And I think that's Solomon's point in Ecclesiastes. He's not even saying you're wrong when you say, I remember days that were better. He's saying it's not a helpful question to try to go back because there aren't any time machines. Instead, you have to look at what opportunities do we have at this moment that we could take advantage of. Number three from last week, inward-focused churches have lots of meetings. And his point, which I thought was, he kind of stretched this text a little bit, in my opinion, but it was an interesting point, so I gave it. His point was that inward-focused churches talk about doing work a lot, but don't do a lot of work. It's not that all meetings are bad. Meetings are sometimes very necessary and helpful, right? You got to get information out, and you have to figure out who's doing what. But if all you do is talk about work and don't do any work, then you're not doing any work, no matter how much you discussed it. The word for that in what's the word for that in government? Committees. What's the B word? Anybody know? Bureaucracy, right? It's almost like a naughty word, right? That we know when there's more talking and less doing, we have a word for that, and it's bad. Okay. His example in Acts chapter 4 is the church is being persecuted. They get together and pray about it. They say, God, do whatever it is you're going to do, and then they get back to work, right? So there's no committee to assess the persecution threat. There's no decision to, you know, figure out how we respond to that. How we respond to that is doing whatever God told us to do beforehand, right? God said, go teach, so we're going to go teach. Well, they're going to kill us. Yeah, we know. So we're going to go teach, right? So his point was churches need to pray more, trust more, and stop trying to kind of outsmart our problems. Instead, use trust in God and say, well, whatever the situation is, here's the direction he's pointing in Scripture. Let's go that way. Well, it's a pretty good point. I mean, I think he stretches that passage a little bit. It's all right. And then number four from last week, inward-focused churches use their resources for themselves. And the examples he gave was, you know, what percentage of your budget is spent where? And what does your budget say about your priorities? Both personally, but then we're not talking personally, we're talking about as a church. As a church, we're going through the budget process right now. Tonight, the deacons got handed a big stack of reports in their inboxes to go through so they could make their proposals for the 2018 budget. And where the church ultimately directs its resources is going to say what is important to us. That's just the way it is for every family, it's the way it is for churches. But it's not just money and budget. Where do we spend our space? Right? What do we do with our space? We have a nice big building. What do we do with it? That tells you what's important to you. What do we do with our resources, our leadership? What do we ask our elders to worry about? Whatever we put in their lap is apparently what's important to us. So if all of their meetings are about one item, that clearly is what the congregation thinks is most important. So I won't ask David, but if you had to guess, what do the elders have to meet about most? Is it reaching the lost, or is it internal problems that we have? We almost even have to ask, right? I mean, just most congregations spend more time figuring out their own stuff. Well, that's what we're saying is, this is important, you need to fix that. And then if we have any time left over, let's go get some lost people. So what Archer is saying is, that tells you something about yourself. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. And where your resources go, and where your leadership is asked to spend their time, what your building is used for, what your budget is spent on, tells you what matters. And if it's all on the inside and not on the outside, that tells you something about yourself that you may not like. So that was his first four observations, and they were brutal. I mean, just to be real honest, it was an unpleasant chapter to read, it was an unpleasant lesson to write, and it was even less pleasant to give it and now to review it. And worse, there's three more points. So, number five, we'll start the new material. Turn to Philippians chapter 2. If somebody wants to read verses 3 and 4, and also verse 14. Philippians chapter 2, 3 and 4, and verse 14. James, thank you.
Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. And verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing.
Go ahead and read verse 15 too. I'm sorry. The reason I like verse 15 is that it tells us that this is not just it's inconvenient if you do the other thing. It's saying in order for you to carry out your purpose in the world, you have to act like this. So if you want to be, what does he call that generation? What does he call the first century generation in Philippi? A crooked and twisted generation. Do we have one of those? Okay. I think most of us would say, yep, we've got one of those. How can the church influence a crooked and twisted generation? Paul says that begins on how the people on the inside act. So the observation from Archer in his book here is, inward-focused churches put their own needs first. In fact, that one almost goes without saying. That's the definition of being inward-focused is me, right? Me first. I'm pointing all the arrows of attention back at what I want. The inward-focused church puts their own needs first. We have a word for that. It's not a biblical word per se, but we have a word for that. Entitlement is the word we often hear. You have a problem with entitlement. You think you're entitled to something. Another word we sometimes hear is privilege. But when you hear a lot about what do we deserve, what should be ours, taking care of me first, that kind of language, whether you call it entitlement or not, the way Paul describes it is, it's not thinking of other people before yourself. Look again in verse 3. Do nothing. And I like the way Paul always leaves things really hanging in the air, vague, right? Do some things. No. He says, do absolutely nothing. No vagueness there at all. From selfish ambition or conceit. Now, what I would say, if I were me, and I was trying to wiggle out from underneath this passage, is I would say, well, I don't have selfish ambition or conceit. I'm not that bad. But then he explains what he means by that in the following phrase. But in humility, count others more significant than yourselves. Paul's definition of selfish ambition is the failure to count other people more significant than yourself. Who is most important to you? And we show that, previous week, we show that by how we act. Okay? You have two friends. They both need picked up at the airport at the exact same time, but it's two separate airports, different ends of town. Which one do you pick up? One you care about most. I mean, to be really blunt, I mean, we'd never say it that way. We'd find a clever excuse. Well, you know, it made sense to go get that one. But the one that you really care about is the one you drop everything and go get that one, and you say sorry to the other one, right? Because I can't be in both places at once. Okay. What about jobs that we do when there's something to be done around the house? If I think of myself first, I know that if I wait long enough, Celine will get frustrated and do it herself. So I can wait her out, right? If I'm thinking of other people first, I say, why should she have to clean up after me? I could go do that. So who you put first, again, that's what's going on here in this terminology. He calls that the difference between humility or conceit, selfish ambition or not. Who are you putting ahead of yourself? How do you value the other person? Jim. You're making a very simple analogy altogether complicated and realistic. Yeah. In reality, that's probably how we would do it. Yeah, we'd ask, you know, who has the reasonable expectation of getting a ride and who's just picking on Jim because he hasn't said no yet. You know, I mean, yeah, fair enough. Okay. There's a class for you down the hall, Jim, anytime you want to go. Just... But yeah, in basic terms, the problem we have that we talk about is entitlement. What is the function of this church? Why does it exist? Does it exist to provide me with a comfortable place to come and fulfill what I feel like are my spiritual responsibilities? Or does it exist to reach people who need the gospel of Christ and bring them to Him? One is inward focused and one is outward. And that makes a difference in how the church is going to behave itself. Not to say we can't do both. To be fair, I do want a place to worship, right? I mean, that is important to me. And I'm glad that we have that. But when one eclipses the other, then we have a problem that Paul's describing here of a selfishness that is ultimately very dangerous. One reason is the entitled person and the entitled church is never content. A person who thinks they deserve things will never get enough of what they feel like they deserve. You can find satisfaction in giving to other people. But there is no amount of getting that ever satisfies us. Have we figured that out yet? I mean, is our completely selfish, entitled culture that we live in, have we figured that out yet? The bankruptcy of selfishness? Are people happier? People have more stuff and more money and more opportunities to buy cheap goods than ever in human history. Are they happier? They're not. One of the fastest growing industries in our country is the mental health industry because we're so happy. Okay? We're not satisfied with anything we're getting. So here's an idea. Maybe thinking people owe me something doesn't make me happy. Maybe there's something looking out that does. Jim, last comment. I'm going to move ahead. Give a kid a present for Christmas, and next year he's going to say, "Well, I had one last year. Don't I get two this year?" I mean, it's a right now. I mean, it's the way it works. Is that all I get? You know, yeah. A privilege becomes a right very quickly. I agree. I'd be happy to banish the word right from our vocabulary and talk only about blessings and privileges and responsibilities, and I'd be happy with that. I would go so far as to say, not only when it stops there, when it begins there, when we start with me, I usually don't get to other people. If I start with other people, you know, I usually don't go hungry. You know, it turns out that if I start by helping others, there's usually enough left over to take care of me too. In fact, it starts to sound a little bit like what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6. If you seek first yourself, no. If you seek first the kingdom of God, God kind of sorts out the other. So if we start with me and then give a little bit while left over to God or to other people, we usually never get there. But if we start with what's important and then find some space for yourself at the end of that bill. Sure, God usually makes sure there's some there.
Like you said, it usually always shows up.
It does. 1 Corinthians 14. Speaking of, I think I mentioned earlier, occasionally he stretches a passage to make his point. I think this passage does a great job of speaking to next week's lesson. I think it has very little to do with this week's, but we'll try because it's in the book. So I'm going to try to be fair and let him make his point. 1 Corinthians 14, if somebody wants to read 17 through 19 and 23 through 25. Jerry, go ahead.
But you do give thanks well, but the other is not edified. I thank my God I speak in tongues more than you all. Yet in the church I would rather speak five words with my understanding, that I may teach others also, than 10,000 words in the tongue.
And 23 through 25.
Therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak in tongues, and there comes one those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you are out of your mind? But if all prophesy, and an unbeliever or an uninformed comes in, he is convinced by all. And thus the secrets of the heart are revealed. The soul falling down his face, he will worship God and report that God is truly among you.
So next week, the discussion is about, what would a person coming in from the outside think about our worship service? Which is the topic here in 1 Corinthians 14 and those verses we read. What if someone walked in and saw that? What would they think about that? So comments on that we're actually going to save for next week. His point here, though, the reason he includes it in this lesson, he says inward-focused churches resist change. And what he means by that, Corinth had something that was out of whack with their worship service. Why don't they just fix it? That's the way they've done it. You don't change your worship service around, right? You get struck by lightning when you do that. If you look in the book of Corinthians, of all the things that are out of whack, from chapter 7 all the way to chapter 14, the majority of the book is just trying to straighten out problems in their worship service, which you think could have been done in like a memo. I mean, a bullet point list. Do this, do this, do this, do this. Let's move on. Let's talk about the resurrection in chapter 15. The resurrection of Jesus gets one chapter. Trying to correct technical issues about how they worship takes 7. And so what Tim Archer's point in the book is, churches have a tendency to resist any change, especially to kind of like how the worship is organized and so forth. Anything, even the smallest change, comes with a lot of resistance. Now, he gives a disclaimer that I think is really important. I put it in yellow so we'd see it. Disclaimer, changing basic beliefs will not attract outsiders. So going back to the early 90s and late 80s, the Churches of Christ are about 20 years behind on it. But anyway, in the 80s and 90s, churches out in kind of evangelical world decided they wanted to be seeker-friendly, and they were going to attract people no matter what. Even if that meant giving up their convictions and beliefs and being quiet about those things, they were going to try to get people in. Willow Creek out west was like the big experiment. Purpose-driven life, Rick Warren, this is his church, okay? And they were going to be the pinnacle of a seeker-friendly church. And anything that would drive a seeker away, we're not doing that. We're going to be get people in this building. And they grew, oh boy, numbers blew off the doors on the place. And people said, that's what we need to do, right? Well, now if you go back to those churches, and Rick Warren will be the first one to tell you, long-term strategy, that was a disaster. Those people didn't stick around. Those people didn't participate in the work of the church. Those people did not develop into Christian disciples. They became spectators and participants. And so now those megachurches that existed in the 80s and 90s are trying to rebuild themselves after they've been evacuated by the people they brought in, having given up all their convictions. But for some reason, the rest of the religious world has said, well, that worked in the 80s and 90s. We should try that again. And we're going back to it after it already failed once. It's a terrible idea. It didn't work then, and it's not going to work now. You don't grow a congregation by compromising or forfeiting the basic tenets of Christianity. That's not how it works. It's not practical. It's not moral. It's not anything. It's not a strategy that works. Okay? It's been tried. In fact, some of these studies that I've mentioned about what millennials are looking for in churches, some of them have even commented that millennials are getting tired of being catered to. I know that sounds strange, so well, I haven't noticed yet. But what they mean by that is they can kind of notice when they go into a church that this is all created to attract me. This church believes in nothing. And some of them go ahead and stick around anyway, and some of them move on. And some of the churches that are growing right now are the awkwardly strange liturgical-type churches that we all thought should have died off. Eastern Orthodox is having a resurgence of population in America. You talk about an odd church with odd traditions and rules. You'd think a millennial would run screaming from that, but their point is, well, they believe in something. And there's some authenticity there to that strangeness. They're having a resurgence that no one could have predicted 10 years ago. And the point is that conviction wins out. People with genuine, authentic convictions are persuasive people, and those churches are growing. I'll say this, and I'll say it very kind of cautiously. I often have conversations with new members or people who are thinking about placing membership. And in the process of doing that, I try to like stealthily kind of test the waters to see, you know, are you kind of in agreement with what we're doing here? Do you find anything we're doing here that makes sense? Do you agree with what you hear taught in the classes and the pulpit? And one thing I have heard more than once from younger members who end up placing membership here is, I don't always agree with everything that is said, but I never doubt that you guys actually believe it. I've heard that more than once from people that end up placing membership here. And to me, I say, well, hey, that's a great place to start, right? So you're willing to sit here and listen, and the first time you heard it, you didn't even agree, but you're going to come back and hear it again because somebody said it with genuine conviction, that they actually believed what they were saying. And I've heard that more than once here. So, disclaimer, changing basic beliefs will not attract outsiders. However, other non-essential elements often present a barrier to outsiders. There are a lot of things we do, because that's why we did it, that get in the way. They aren't the essential doctrines of Christianity. They aren't any doctrines of Christianity. It's just things that we've happened to have done a certain way. For the inward-focused church, doing things the way we do them tends to take precedence over doing things in a way, in a way that might help the church grow. So, Paul's point here in Corinth, or Tim Archer's point about Paul's point in Corinth, is they were very happy to have a confusing mess in their worship service. And Paul says, what would that look like to somebody that came in? Is this the way we want our worship to be? And so he's advocating we need to make a change about that. Not even for our own benefit, but for the benefit of someone who may come in. So the outward-focused church, I don't think, gives up on their convictions and becomes one of these seeker-friendly, nebulous, believe-in-anything churches. But they do look around and say, what matters and what doesn't? What matters and what gets in the way of what matters? And those are hard questions, maybe the hardest questions, of which ones are which. We spend our lives trying to sort out which ones are which. But I think that's the questions we have to ask. I'm going to run out of time.
Yeah.
Sir. The short answer is yes. It is typically an outward focus in an unhealthy degree. In my view, I've had a chance to talk to a few church leaders who have been involved in making that decision, that switch, and I always have the same question. You know, what's the motivation? I mean, I'm assuming they and I disagree over some of the scriptures, but what's the motivation for it is what I want to know. And the answer they give me is usually the same. We felt like it got in the way of reaching people. But what I think is more realistic is to realize convictions don't get in the way of reaching people if they're placed in a place that's healthy. People respect those things about you, even people who don't necessarily agree, who say, you know, I'm not sure if I'm persuaded by your argument on instrumental music, that you guys worship in a way that's decent and reasonable, and I appreciate what you're doing. I mean, that I don't see that getting in the way. I have not, I've been a minister since, in some capacity, since I was 15. I can't remember ever having a conversation with any person that told me they wouldn't come to church at a Church of Christ because we didn't have an instrument. Never. Now, I've had some that said, I don't agree with it, or I wish you did, or whatever, but none of them ever said, that was the reason. I don't think that's why people make their decisions. I really don't. There may have been a time when they did, but anymore, I just don't hear that. And to be honest, it's the strangeness of the modern world. Let's play this out like a modern thinking person for a moment. I'll try to be someone else. There are so many different worship styles. How can I complain about the Church of Christ worship style? For them, it's just one more style. Now, for me, it's more than a style. But for them, it's just one more style. They don't really care. That was their point to start with. And so, by and large, if they saw Christianity on display here, I've never had someone tell me, I agree with everything you do, but I just can't go there because you don't have an instrument. It's never happened to me. It probably has happened to somebody. I'm going to get 10 hands now. But it's never happened to me. And when the younger groups I talk to, young families, that topic doesn't even come up. And I'm always nervous. Well, you may notice we don't have an instrument. You know, and I'm like, oh, yeah, they don't care. They don't care. Again, they may not be convinced that we're right about it, but they don't care one way or the other. So they come and they listen, which is the goal, for them to come and to listen and maybe learn something, we hope. Jennifer, did you have your hand up, or was I? Don't stretch back there. I will call on you. Okay. All right, let's get one more in. Number 7. The inward-focused church, and we're going to come back to that last one, by the way, next week. And so I just kind of want to hit it in passing. Number 7, though, the inward-focused churches celebrate the wrong things. Passages he mentions, if you want to read these, we'll get two different readers. One in Hebrews 13:7, somebody else in 1 Corinthians 16:17-18. So I have two different readers. Who has Hebrews 13:7? Casey, thank you. So what is being held out as an example in that passage that the church turns to and says, hey, look at that, that's great? The faith of leaders. Okay, faithfulness is the characteristic. Leaders are singled out, but it's the characteristic of, look at their faithfulness and celebrate that. Who has 1 Corinthians 16:17-18? Thought I saw him. Made it up. 1 Corinthians 16:17-18. Edwin, thank you.
I'm glad about the coming of Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaeus.
Well, that's why no one wanted to read it, because there were names in it. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
For what was lacking on your part, they supplied it. For they refreshed my spirit and yours. Therefore, acknowledge such men.
Acknowledge is the word there. I mean, hold up. He calls names. These people are doing a good work. Acknowledge that. So Archer's point in the book is, there's a funny update on my screen. I don't want that. Leave me alone. A healthy church celebrates the kingdom more than other things. A church shares things together, mourning and joy. James chapter 5, if you're happy, sing a song. If you're mourning, say a prayer. I mean, the Christians cry together and we sing together and we do it all, right? When people have a funeral, what do Christians do? We get together and we mourn together and we have a meal and we do things. When someone has an accomplishment, we celebrate that and we do different phases. Somebody has a baby, right? And we have a shower. Nobody in here has babies, do they, Casey? No. Okay. When somebody has a baby, right, we celebrate it and we have a big deal because different moments of life call for different things, right? Sometimes we mourn together and sometimes we celebrate together. And all that's important for a church. What a church can't do is get so focused on kind of patting ourselves on the back with, look at what you've accomplished. Look at the prestigious people we've got here. You know, so back 100 years ago, J.D. Tant was a preacher I like to talk about. Bill and I swap J.D. Tant stories because he's the one that every preacher grew up wanting to be, was J.D. Tant. They don't make him like J.D. Tant anymore. He wrote into the Gospel Advocate. And the Gospel Advocate, for a long time, they had this custom where if you had a gospel meeting somewhere, you wrote to the Gospel Advocate and they would publish your results. We had 15 baptisms, including the mayor, and notable persons. And so J.D. Tant wrote in and said, we had no baptisms, we withdrew from 3 sinners, and one guy came forward and came back to church, and he was a miserable sinner, but he came back. Anybody want to tell me that's not important? J.D. Tant was a Texas guy. He was really gutsy. But his point was, Why would we celebrate the mayor's baptism and not the sinner's repentance? I mean, why would we act like there are people we really are proud of around here, and then there are other people we don't? He said, we're celebrating the wrong things. Doing the right thing is worth celebration. Kingdom things are worth celebration. We made a determination to do this here recently. We're still running the little video of the two baptisms we've had recently. We might run it another month. I haven't decided yet. Because baptisms ought to be celebrated, like a long time. It ought to be a big deal. It ought to be as significant an event in a person's life as a baby shower or a funeral or any of the other things we share together. Churches need to celebrate the right things. When our leaders make a tough, good decision, we say, good for them. Lucas, look at that. That's the way we grow up to be. I mean, that's what we do with our kids. We're celebrating those things in faith. An inward-focused church celebrates the things that make them feel really good about themselves. An outward-focused church celebrates good service, good work, conversion to Christ Jesus. A healthy church's most talked about events are those that reach outsiders, not insiders. What's our most important event? I don't know. Don't answer that. Whatever it is, it better not be one that satisfies me. It better be one that's for other people. If our most important event is the one that makes me happy, then we probably have the wrong one first, don't we? It ought to be, what does it do for others? Are we reaching the lost with that? Last thought, and then they're going to start storming in. We have to cut a few minutes short tonight for the boys' devotional. In Haggai chapter 1, verses 2 through 11, we won't read it because we're not going to have time, but go home and read it tonight. This is, they come back after captivity and then they're rebuilding the temple. Only they're not. They get started rebuilding the temple. And then they kind of slow down. Because, you know, I got to rebuild my house too. And everybody goes back to their farm and starts working on their farm. And everybody starts working on their house. And the lumber that they had brought in to use in the temple, well, kind of piece at a time, I need a piece of that for my house. And they start using it on their own little projects. And the temple comes to a halt. And so Haggai has this great speech in Haggai chapter 1 where he says, your pockets are empty and your crops are dead. You know why? Because you built your house before the temple. And what Haggai's point is, God will not permit a selfish people to succeed. He will cut a hole in the bottom of your pocket rather than let you succeed in selfishness. If we become an inward-focused church, or if we have already become an inward-focused church, God will trip us up and cause us to fail. I believe that. He will cause us to fail rather than succeed. If, on the other hand, we're outward-focused and we look first at building the temple, we look first at whatever it is God demands of us at this moment in time, and that comes first before our own priorities, I think, as Christ says, and all these things will be added unto you. God takes care of the other stuff when you put him first. Okay, next week we'll talk more about worship service and having outsiders in a worship service and what that means. Thanks for your attention and comments. Appreciate it.